Now, last week I pronounced Joseph Pierce as Colonel Pierce, so I think I'm going to promote you to the rank of Colonel as well. Colonel Dineen, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm well. Tell me about this whirlwind tour that you're doing at Yale.
Oh, it's hardly that. I had to get out of that sunny South Bend weather to come into the midst of a storm in the Northeast. there's a nice group here. It's called the William F. Buckley Society, founded by some students here.
Oh.
And during the Yale spring break, they run little seminars for their students on topics that they feel don't get enough coverage in their regular curriculum, for which they pay upwards of $50,000, $60,000 a year.
Wow.
So they bring in ringers like me to come in and talk about I'm talking about Alexis de Tocqueville, and they've had people to come in and talk about the Federalist Papers and Plato. So we're the guest, the pinch hitters, I guess you could say.
Well, one bright spot is that I have not read that you have been middle buried yet.
Well, it's interesting you would say that. The next appearance of Charles Murray is going to be at the University of Notre Dame. So we'll find out.
Now, is there enough of a radical revolutionary crowd in your fine institution?
We're going to find out. But Notre Dame is a different institution than Middlebury for certain. Although I do think we have some students, faculty, et cetera, and even potentially outside agitators who might try to take advantage of the visibility that event in Notre Dame probably can give it. But we have a really substantial number of students and faculty who are just interested in hearing what he has to say. You know, they may disagree with him, they may agree with him, but I think he has important things to say about the divide in our country today, the reasons for the bitterness of the election and the outcome of the election, but especially for institutions that claim to be so concerned about social justice, to think about the way that our institutions are really not serving members of our, you know, citizenry, people, our fellow citizens, who are really suffering in parts of the country where they're not going to live and they're not going to have to see them and interact with them. I think that's one of the best things that Charles Murray's been doing in this book, Coming Apart.
Well, and there was a prequel, or the book that came before Coming Apart, where he kind of began this work. And my friend and a colleague of yours of sorts, Professor Dr. Kevin Gutzman, and I did a show on this about 2 weeks ago. And Kevin's an avid reader of Murray, going all the way back to the early 90s. And Kevin says, people don't realize the body of this man's work.
Yeah.
I mean, it is substantial. I mean, Charles Murray hasn't been cooped up in some little office playing professor emeritus for the last 30 years.
No, it's pretty shameful. In fact, the events at Middlebury were just a deep mark of shame on the academy, certainly on that institution. You had professors fomenting this activity who fully admitted that they had never even read a word that he had written. And I mean, if a professor can't do that, then they're not, I mean, they ought not to even have that position or title.
Now, Patrick, before we get started with some really interesting things, I spent the first hour of the show today pointing out to people a couple of things, and I suppose this will have a little bit about what we're about to talk about. And one of these things is, one of the things that Rod Dreher writes about often in his talks and his writings on his Benedict option is that Christianity or Christians need to form a, or need to start, or need to get more serious about a counterculture. And every time he does it, I try to fraternally and then publicly correct him that, Rod, no, Christianity is capital T, the capital C, cult. It's what the West is. There is no West without Christianity, and there is no culture.
Right. I have a book that's going to come out about 6 months. It's with the not provocative title called Why Liberalism Failed, which is actually going to come out with Yale Press, so I just talked with some people here. But I have a chapter in that book called Liberalism as Anti-Culture, and I think that's probably maybe the better way to think about what the liberal order does. It empties culture, and that's one of its primary purposes, is to empty culture of all varieties, religious, in many ways artistic. We could say that formative soil in which human beings grow up, and to render it a kind of almost the version of a kind of industrial agriculture, a kind of monoculture that produces the same kind of person. And the anti-culture that we have today is not producing human beings that are flourishing in the way in which certainly in our faith, philosophical and faith tradition would understand. So I think rather than calling it a counterculture, we need to really call it a counter anti-culture or simply culture. I think you're right about that.
And then I was pointing out, I said, let's look at it. I said, I can do this on any given day, just going through news headlines at Yahoo News or DrudgeReport.com. Let's just talk about the Rachel Maddow incident with the release of Donald J. Trump's 2005 tax return. Now, we know that these were obtained surreptitiously. He didn't rend them over. We know in 2005, Patrick Deneen and Mike Church, where I was doing radio, you were doing professor things, what Donald Trump paid or did not pay on his income taxes had absolutely no bearing on me whatsoever. Didn't harm me, didn't injure me, didn't promote me. It was neutral on me. It is no business of a public, doesn't have any bearing whatsoever on his presidency. Formerly, in a culture that had ethics, certainly Christian ethics, this would have been an ethical breach that I don't think whatever would have seen the light of day. What do you say?
Well, people have been playing dirty politics for a long time, so I'm not sure that we can look back and say categorically this wouldn't have happened. But I think what we can say is there's a shamefulness now that exists in our political civil order. It's you know, there's a saying that hypocrisy is the compliment that vice pays to virtue. That even if you have the vice in question, you still don't want to expose it. And I think we've passed that. People are just willing to expose their vices. This seems to me to be a pretty good example.
Well, I'll give you another example. One of your colleagues, Austin Ruse, had a piece at Crisis Magazine's website last week about homophobia. And he pointed out three examples of things that have occurred publicly since Obergefell, and three media instances. One where there was sex counseled for adult males seeking to have relations with teenage boys, and how great that was. There was another one that was to prep teenagers for sodomy. And the third one, the only one that made any sense, was an admission by another guy in the Advocate newspaper, where he began to lament all that he had done in taking the advice of the first two, and the ruins of a life that pursues the unnatural act and all the unnatural lifestyle and habits that go along with a gay lifestyle. And some of the statistics in there are just shocking. I mean, to tell a teenager that, yeah, you know, you want to go ahead and pursue your homosexuality, you're basically saying, you know what, it's a good thing that you're going to have a 66% chance, you're going to be 66% more likely to kill yourself than your heterosexual counterparts. This amounts to child abuse of sorts.
Yeah, and I've been reading, a few texts right now about paganism and the pagan era, and the belief that basically a life lived without a kind of moral guide was an Epicurean lifestyle was the good life. was a view that was held by a civilization a long time ago. And with the advent of Christianity, there was a different way of life that was proposed. And it turned out that when pagans began really looking at that way of life, a life that was ordered and disciplined, that lived within the boundaries of morality, it turns out they said, hey, I want to live like that because those people are happy. I think that's in some ways what Rod Dreher is proposing in his book, which is, we have to think increasingly about living as a kind of, not necessarily even as a counterculture, but as a kind of a beacon, or as an exemplar, as a different kind of city on the hill, we might say.
Yeah, and speaking of city on a hill, I also had told the audience last week, if you want to read a good historical account of the shining city on the hill, get Richard Gamble's book about it.
Richard's a good friend, and it's just a terrific book. It's a very It's a book that really reveals something very deep about America, I think.
What is it?
Well, what it reveals is the idea of American exceptionalism. While it's in some ways it's always been around, the kind of transformation from what Winthrop was saying in that sermon, City
right.
on the Hill, was really about a kind of America that lived by an exemplary Christian way of life, and especially a way of life that focused on the goodness of the community. The goodness of, and Winthrop was proposing this to the people on the ship on the way over, and that they needed to avoid the temptations that especially were going to be presented to them in this new world, in this wilderness, the temptations to grandiosity and pride and empire and power and materialism. And how that phrase, City on the Hill, eventually got sort of co-opted by a different kind of American exceptionalism, which really was about power
mm-hmm.
and wealth
mm-hmm.
and prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
And not that there's anything wrong with, you know, having enough coin to provide for your family, but something very different turn was made in that phrase. And so the phrase that disappeared for a long time, as Gamble points out, and then was revived during the Cold War to really describe something rather different. So it really describes not only the course of that phrase, but it describes the course of the kind of way in which American exceptionalism was changed and transformed.
I was just fascinated and quite frankly, as an amateur historian, embarrassed at the paucity of my abilities at the scholarship. I mean, he went and found documents that the ones that he was able to locate, and in proving that some of the other ones never existed, they were more oral than they were ever written down. He was able to demonstrate a paper trail for the Mayflower Compact and the other writings and urban legends around it that you'll never be privy to reading again, I don't think, and I had never been privy to reading previously. And it's just a magnificent historical work. And it's a little book. It won't tell you, it's not like it's 500 pages long. I think it was maybe 180 pages or so. So it was a pleasant read, and boy howdy, by the time I was finished with it, I had an earful and a brainful of why today's John Bolton-infused American exceptionalism is a pox on all our houses, right?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the way in which the idea of American exceptionalism in many ways begins is to be an exemplary example of a kind of way of living that was meant to be really in distinction to Europe, and that really was transformed. So I agree with you. And, you know, the other part of Richard Gamble's argument, and this is this reflects other work that he's done as well, is the way that Americanism itself became kind of a religion. It became a civil religion, and how much Christianity was folded into this kind of American civil religion. And I think that's something else that's something Richard Gamble's written about really quite powerfully. And I think that's something that we're beginning, I think many Christians are beginning to understand that we have to be much more reflective and cautious about.
844-527-8723 is our telephone number. It's the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, on our app at Veritas Radio Network app, on our website at crusadechannel.com, and on my site at mikechurch.com. My special guest is Patrick Dineen. He a professor at the University of Notre Dame and an author in his own right. Let's get into the Benedict option for a moment. It's kind of hard to say, transmit in 132 measly characters. What I was meaning to say about your essay that appeared at firstthings.com about 10 days or so ago, what I meant to say, in case it didn't come across, is that Mr. Dineen, Colonel Dineen, the subject that you covered is secondary to the essay that you ultimately wrote on the subject, or the subjects, the three books, to me, are secondary to what you wrote on the same subject, which is kind of like a mini book. But we'll talk about the three books. So there's three books that Patrick covered. Rod Dreher's The Benedict Option, Archbishop Charles J. Chaput's The Strangers in a Strange Land, Living the Catholic Faith in a Post-Christian World, and, of course, the inimitable Anthony Esolen, Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture. And I have the privilege of having spoken to Professor Esolen in the last 40 days or so. So I have some of those ideas from him as well. And where I thought we would start is Rod Dreher is, I think, doing a signal service, regardless of what flaws there may be in his argument. And I think there's flaws in almost anyone's argument. We're human, after all. Regardless of what flaws may be in his argument, the signal service that is being done is that this the name, even if, Patrick, even if just the name of Saint Benedict, and I wish people would start saying the Saint Benedict option and not the Benedict option, even if just the name of Saint Benedict becomes popular again, and in the off chance that 10,000 people may go off and actually read the biography of the man or seek to find out who this Saint Benedict character was, I say that's a victory.
I agree with you. And in fact, one of one of the hallmarks of the book, of Rod's book, is it begins, it begins by talking about the kind of cultural devastation and the kind of state of the sort of perilous state for Christians today in America. But when he begins the constructive part of his project, sort of what are Christians to do now in this context, he begins with the monastery that Saint Benedict founded in Nursia, Italy. Mm-hmm. And he really talks at some length about the kind of life that they lead there, the discipline or the rule under which they live, and the attractions of a life lived under that kind of voluntary submission to discipline and order. And he paints, I think, a very, very attractive portrait for, I think, a country and a people that are increasingly, desperate and in kind of desperate straits for an order, a capacity to live an ordered moral and disciplined life.
And the other thing about Saint Benedict that is probably not as well known, but maybe will come out of all this, is that when Saint Benedict withdrew, he didn't withdraw in the sense that, even though he did basically create the monastic life, the monastery was open to anyone that was willing to follow the rule. It's, to me, the signal thing that Benedict does is he takes the Gospels and he turns them into what we call today a rule, or what if you're going to go found a brotherhood of monks or a sisterhood of nuns, and it's a new one, then you would call that an order. And in the order, you would fashion a rule. And then you would send your rule to your ordinary, who would then send it to his ordinary. And ultimately, if it's going to cross across countries or whatever, the Pope or someone in the Vatican will ultimately see it and say yay or nay. But understand what the rule is. And I think that this is what is the most important part about Saint Benedict. The rule is basically kind of like an owner's manual for a Christian who just got into the gospel car. Here's how you cannot, here's how to treat the gospel car with love and tenderness and TLC and keep it running, and maintained well. Not enough goes, I don't think enough is said about that part of what it was that Saint Benedict did.
You know, I just checked Amazon.com this morning. I was curious to see how Rod's book was doing on the first day of its release. It's doing pretty well. It's up there ranked number one or two or three.
Good.
But you know how Amazon always suggests additional books that you might want to order if you're interested in this book. One of the top books that it suggests is The Rule of Saint Benedict. So I think your wish might be coming true that people are not only curious about Rod Dreher, but they're also getting curious about Saint Benedict.
So I've made a resolution this Lent to learn. I'm going to go buy that book when you and I hang up.
That sounds like a real fun time, Mike.
Well, I don't think I'm going to attempt it. I think I just want to know it.
Sure.
This isn't 434. I'm not living at the time of Benedict and Augustine. This is the time of Deneen and church here. This is the time of college football and the NCAA or college basketball and the NCAA 64 seed tournament, my friend.
I'm well aware of it. We've got two of our teams in that tournament, men and the women.
Well, at least as someone, most kids that go to Notre Dame at least know that it's a Catholic institution.
They do.
I wonder, I asked you this question last time you were on, how many kids go to Gonzaga know that there's a St. Aloysius in front of the Gonzaga?
They have a room down a hall where you could find that out.
Let's get to the nuts and bolts of the, because there's two other books here. Archbishop Charles Chaput. Who is one of the, and this is a rarity today, I believe, isn't Chaput one of the signatories of the Dubia?
I don't think so.
Who is it? So it's
Cardinal Raymond Burke.
It's Burke?
Yeah.
I can't think of the other three. Anyway, but Chaput would be one of those that you would think might be a signatory.
I think he certainly probably has concerns about
Amoris Laetitia.
Yeah.
But he is I've seen several talks by him, whenever I get my hands on anything that he's written, I read "Strangers in a Strange Land: Living the Catholic Faith in a Post-Christian World." You say of the three that Chaput comes closest to seeing that, hey, we got to live in this world. We should make an attempt to kind of fix it. You say he comes closest to it. Are you saying that he doesn't say that? You got to form your own mainstreams, if you will, or that they're, no, we can fix this. We got this.
Well, I think that many American bishops for a long time have really focused on how the church can influence the American political order. I mean, I think they've seen this as one of their primary jobs. If you think about all the various letters that the bishops have written over the years, going back to, you know, the letters about nuclear weapons and the letters about poverty and economics and the letters about religious liberty, the thought is that as bishops, they can have a kind of influence on, a beneficial influence on the American political order. And what I discern in the book, in this latest book by Archbishop Chaput, is a real change of tone and emphasis. He doesn't call for us to be complacent or not to pay attention to the political order, but our first order of business as Christians is to attend to our faith and to our church and to our faith communities, and to build up, especially in our parishes and in our communities, to build up a kind of faithful witness that's ultimately going to be more powerful and more sustaining in terms of the kind of witness it can bring than any kind of political pressure you might bring to the U.S. Congress or to the Supreme Court or to the presidency.
Well, and I thought one of the points that we'll get into this in a little more detail, one of the points that you made at the end of the Moral Minority essay at First Things is that you say that, all right, Rod and Anthony, you say that politics can't fix this, but we certainly have to have a better politics. if we'll know that we've repaired the situation if we have a better politics. I think that's a brilliant way to put it, that, you know, politics, our politics, secular, little r Republican, Democratic politics, you're right, we're not going to fix this. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a place for politics.
Yeah, this was, I think, the overwhelming conclusion that I reached was that these books are written in the aftermath of an effort, and this is really the kind of the thrust of the piece, was to talk about the 30, 40, 50-year effort, especially beginning with evangelical Christians, the moral majority, the joining of that with conservative Catholics and other groups, to really try to bring a kind of moral, social conservative voice to the public scene, but to do that through the engine, especially of the federal government, through federal elections, through Supreme Court appointments and the like. And so in a sense, to try to argue for something that this particular political system could never deliver, and in fact in which this particular political system is really in many ways designed to undermine. It's designed, as I was saying earlier, it's designed to undermine a kind of culture and in its place put in an anti-culture that's largely driven by individualism, materialism, and voluntarism, the idea that we make our own lives and create our own identities. The conclusion of many of the people who are now looking at the wreckage of our moment is to say, well, okay, so politics didn't work, let's now retreat to the monasteries. And I think that that impulse is not incorrect, but it's not complete.
Okay.
That there is a need to begin to think about building up communities of faith and communities of witness. But there's also a need for us to begin thinking of a different kind of politics, not simply conforming ourselves to the basic assumptions of the modern liberal order. So I take it that if we're engaged in a division of labor, I'll take on that. I'll take on that job. But I just wanted to remind the authors of the book and the readers of these books that just because our efforts in this particular political order haven't borne out, it doesn't mean that we have to be unconcerned about the nature of the political order that we might flourish in.
Well, I'm ready to return to the Book of Judges. How about you?
That's not a bad place to start.
You know, every person that knows of the Book of Judges says pretty much the same thing. That's a pretty good place to start. I think I can live in that town. It's the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel, King Size Truth from Radio Size Speakers. My special guest is Patrick Dineen, the University of Notre Dame, and the author, as you said, of an upcoming book. What was the title again?
Why Liberalism Failed.
That is a thrilling title.
Quite a top boiler.
Liberalism Failed. And the essay is responsible for Moral Minority, which we discussed at great length on last week's program. Just another sidebar on that discussion there about the need for politics. Just because these politics fail doesn't mean that all politics are doomed to fail. You know, if we go back to the roots of the American order, as Russell Kirk would like to call it, and he did in a book, Kirk covered this as well. You know, part of that order, that American exceptional order that your friend Richard Gamble wrote about in the Myth of the Shining City book, begins with John Locke. And his singular pronouncement that, well, there has to be a social compact order. It's as simple as that. His revolt against, and it was a revolt, he continues the revolt against the authority of the ultimate authority, which is, okay, folks, get ready. Here it comes. The C word's coming. The Holy Roman Catholic Church. It cannot be lost on the modern man that the beginning of Henry VIII's public life begins with appeals and acknowledgement to the Pope. He cannot marry Catherine of Aragon, and he knows he can unless the Pope says that he can. England, at the time, there's no one else in England that could have married their brother's widow unless the Pope or the bishop had granted a dispensation. You got to understand this, folks. If you don't get this, then you can have all the Benedict Order books you want. You're never going to get back to where we got to go. And so tracing it forward from Henry, then all of what happens, just the treachery of the House of Tudor, and somebody needs to write a book with that title, the treachery of the House of Tudor, it goes all the way up, and then Locke takes the ball and runs with it. The American founders are very familiar with Locke. Of course, Jefferson quotes him often. They're also very familiar with one of Locke's students, and he may have been a little bit more philosophical, and that is the heretic, and the admitted heretic, and avowed heretic, David Hume. And, you know, Hume is famous for saying, even if you show me a miracle, I'm going to say that you didn't actually show it to me, so I didn't see it. Hume, though, did give us, just as an example of what you were talking about, Hume did give us the concept of the perfect commonwealth, which I think that in the way that he broke it down, he's still largely correct. You just need the Christian, need the Christian order on top of the perfect commonwealth. If we view these things, it is conceivable, Patrick, we could have a Republican form of government that got the order correct and put the church back in charge of moral affairs and acknowledged its subsidiarity role, couldn't we?
We're in a really, and part of the reason why I wrote my book and why I think these three books we're discussing are so important is that we're at a moment where I think we've exhausted one project, and the project was really, we could say it's the 500-year experiment of whether we could build a political order that was permissive of or tolerant toward any particular view that a human being might have, any particular way of life that a human being might have, the liberal order. And that included beliefs, religious beliefs, so there was toleration of any particular religious view.
Sure.
And we're really kind of at the end of this experiment. And let's face it, it was an experiment. It had never been tried before.
True.
It's like we are the test tube. America has been the test tube of this of this particular experiment. I mean, what the founders themselves regarded as an experiment. And no one knew how it was going to turn out. I think we're kind of reaching the end, and we're finding out, you know what, it probably may not work. And it may not work in particular because when everybody pursues whatever it is they want to do, two things happen. First of all, there's no order at all. And second of all, it turns out the only thing that can keep it together is a large imposition of state power, of centralized state power. It's the only thing that holds us together anymore. It's kind of like the cauldron that will keep us from all spilling out. So both of those things are happening simultaneously. We're becoming both more disordered internally. You can see it in all of the social dislocations, the rates of divorce and the rates of abortion and the rates of childlessness and the drug abuse throughout the country. I mean, you just go down on the list of horrors. At the same time, we have an ever-growing central power, regardless of which party holds office, which isn't just accidental. It's a ratchet wrench that only moves in one direction. It only increases as the kind of disorder of the country increases. So I think we're really at a moment when we actually need that old-fashioned thing called political philosophy, among other things, and theology, to begin to think our way through, okay, so what's next?
I'm ready. And I'm listening to you speak, and I'm going like, okay, so Dineen basically just said that Hobbes got it right in Leviathan. That man will go out and kill himself unless he has a large menacing state called Leviathan that tells him not to.
I think we're living out Hobbes's vision.
That is shocking because, folks, if you ever seen the cover of the book Leviathan, that's a horror show right there. And it was meant to be horrifying. And the thought that we are living out Hobbes's vision ought to chasten anyone for a path forward to through the Western, it's not even the Western, is it? Through the American tradition of what we have been pursuing all these years. But, you know, Patrick, to be fair, at the time of the Constitution's ratification, there were very concerned Protestants and Catholics that said, you guys got the order wrong. What is this we the people stuff? This is a recipe for disaster. So it's not as though the urban legend is that everyone thought it was the greatest thing that ever happened and everyone was on board. That is just simply not true.
I teach a class in which, among other things, I teach not only the Federalist Papers, I teach the Anti-Federalist Papers, and I expose my students to the debate that took place, and it was a pretty vigorous debate at the time of the founding. And what floors my students, never ceases to floor my students, is that all of the arguments that were made by the Anti-Federalists more or less came true.
Mm-hmm.
They're concerned about centralization. They're concerned about an uncontrolled Supreme Court. They're concerned about a society that would become immoral, especially in its pursuit of material goods, a society that would lose its actual independence to its reliance upon foreign powers, especially economically, even to the point where a president would go and bow to a foreign leader. So, I mean, you read this list of claims about the proposed Constitution, none of which could be immediately seen, all of which are said, these are things that could happen in the future. And you're struck that, you know, these were visible even at the time when the Constitution was being debated.
And the most profound examples of this are to be found, folks, if you're interested in reading it. You can get Jackson Turner Main's book, The Anti-Federalist. That's a great place to start.
I agree. There's another little book by Herbert Storing called What the Anti-Federalists Were For.
Oh, Herbert.
About 75 pages long. Wonderful little summary.
And then I was also going to, and I've been suggesting this for a decade, 8 years since I made my movie, The Spirit of 76, Volume 9 and Volume 10 and Volume 11 of the University of Wisconsin Press's Documentary History on the Ratification of the Constitution, which covers the Virginia Convention. Now, you can get this kind of in a digital format today because you can get it at the Online Library of Liberty. They have digitized it from another work. And you can word search it for Mr. Henry in there. And all you need to do is read Patrick Henry, the Episcopalian's commentary on the Constitution and what he accurately said was going to go wrong, clause by clause. And I don't think that Henry was gifted with being clairvoyant or seeing into the future. I just think that he knew his religion pretty good. He knew the nature of man, and he knew how this had worked out previously when anything remotely like it had been attempted. And he was able to predict, well, this is what's going to happen. So those are two great works. It's the Mike Church Show here on the Crusade Channel. King Size Truth from radio size speakers on our app, available free of charge from the Android store or from the Google Play store and from the iTunes store. Search for Veritas, V-E-R-I-T-A-S, radio network app, and download to your heart's content. We will have, now that we have two kind of mini lectures from Professor Dineen, a Patrick Dineen's greatest hits piece up later on today at MikeChurch.com. You didn't know that you were auditioning for an album, did you?
No, I didn't.
I don't want to run you off. If you have a little more time, I'd like to continue. Can we continue to the top of the hour?
That'd be fine, yeah.
Okay, great. Let's go back to one of the there's an 800-pound elephant in the room. And no one wants to address it, or few. I shouldn't say no one, because that's not true. Few want to address it. I don't have any fear of addressing it, because I'm the owner of these radio airwaves. Look, I was determined too Catholic for satellite radio. We know how that turned out. I don't think I'm going to be too Catholic for Crusade Channel Radio, or as we're live from Crusadia, and we live in Crusade City. So here's the 800-pound elephant in the room that no one or few people wish to wrap their brains around, and to also promote in the manner in which Rod Dreher is promoting the Benedict option. Saint Benedict was a Roman Catholic. In full stop, end of story. That's the fact. He acknowledged the authority of the Pope. He wouldn't have had a rule if the Pope hadn't told him that he could have it. He did not. He didn't challenge the doctrines and dogmas of the Fathers or of the Church, the Desert Fathers, or any of the Gospels or any of the previous councils. He knew his. The point is, he knew his religion well, and he attempted to live it. Now, again, we're not trying to go back to Norcia, Italy. We live in the modern world. But, Patrick, there seems to be a trepidation out there amongst the vast, vast majority, 97%, 98%, I'll just make a number up, that will not say what Brother Andre Marie will say and what I will say, that, look, I wish to live under a benevolent Catholic government. End of story, full stop. I will live under the auspices of a new St. King Louis the Ninth. I live under the Book of Judges, made Catholic and for the Christian world. What I think is the irony is of this is I don't think, whenever I've talked to Protestant friends about this and I tell them what it would be like, they don't have much opposition to it. They say, well, I think I could do that. But we won't pronounce, like what Brother Andre says, what Brother Francis used to say, my Philosophia Pronensis teacher, look, why stop at a little hamlet in New Hampshire? I want to Catholicize the continent. That's the Franciscans and the Dominicans that came and converted the savage barbarian cannibals in Mexico were clear about what they intended to do. It was to capture that convert that continent. They could have known how big it was for the Holy Roman Catholic Church, and they did it. Were there crooked men that became conquistadors? Of course there were. We're fallen men. There's always going to be. But at least they knew the road. If someone walked up to them and said, where are you going? Going to make Mexico Catholic. Okay, that's good. I'll help you. We won't do that for some reason, though. Why?
Well, I mean, the obvious reason why that we won't do that is we have a completely different political philosophy and an underlying philosophy of human beings that there is no good and there is no right and there is no truth, and so you form your political order under a belief that there's no way of reaching or understanding what the true or the good is, and you know, that's the basis of the political order that we live under. I guess my reaction to the call for a Catholic political order is, on the one hand, I don't think it's not disallowed by the Bible as I read it, but it's also not necessarily called for by the Bible as I read it.
Okay.
I think along with Dreher and Chaput and Esselin, I've been reading a good amount of Saint Augustine, with reading along my friend Chad Pecknold on his Twitter reading course. And Augustine just continually reminds us that one has to, in some ways, always be prepared to endure the world, to endure the imperfection of the city of man, not to look to the city of man for ultimate perfection, to prefer the good over the evil, to hope for the good. And I think the three books that I reviewed and that are under discussion were all cautions, especially to modern Americans who have become, who have really begun looking for all the answers in politics. And I think that's what the upshot of these books are. It's to warn people who have really, even critics of the government, have really begun to look for answers from the government. We could say that the rise of Ronald Reagan was both a great success for conservatism, but in many ways it was also the beginning of the failure of conservatism, political conservatism, because it looked for answers in some ways from the government, and more conservatives just wanted to get elected and live in Washington, D.C. So I think these three books are calling for us not to put our eggs into the political basket, and that the main thing is to live a Christian life as best one can, and certainly preferably with other good Christians and Christian communities. The nation state may not be the right vessel. It may not be the right political vessel into which we put our eggs. It seems to me that subsidiarity really calls for thinking about politics on a much more local scale. And that, at the end of my piece, I really call for us not to abandon politics, but if we're going to work to build better cultures, cultures are always built at the local level. Cultures are always sort of built from the ground up. So I think I take those cautions of those books with great advisement.
Well, when I say Catholic, I mean universal.
Yes.
It's not St. Mary's. St. Mary's isn't going to run. control. It's not going to have control. Or the Sacred Heart of Jesus Church.
I agree. I think that as a matter of political principle, and as a matter of we could say a deeper anthropology, a deeper philosophy of the human person, any government that's run on the understanding of and indeed the guidance of Catholic social teaching is to be so profoundly preferred to our contemporary political system. It doesn't require a kind of revolution. It doesn't require an overturning of either the modern or the American political order. One of the things I say in the book that I mentioned is that in many ways liberalism and the liberal order colonized an older order. It took all of its words, it took all of its language, it took all of its concepts, liberty and constitutionalism and limited government and rights. It took all of that great medieval language and concepts and colonized them with a completely different definition.
Right.
And I think it's just a matter of recolonization, as far as I'm concerned, that the first piece of work is to begin to replace the false definitions of those concepts and terms with the true definitions of those concepts and terms.
Well, I'm willing to found the colony of Crusadia. You're welcome to come and help found the university.
I'll be your
here.
Secretary of State.
Let me hit you with one more thing before you leave. We talked about this on the show. I don't know if you noticed. I talk about this every day. This to me is what politics used to be for me. This is what is important and what people ought to be talking about. We need to, and I still do the politics, and I try to, frame it in or discuss it under the, where is the order? Who should have ultimate authority in this particular matter on this issue or whatever? And we can usually go back to that Catholic social doctrine that you were talking about, or just a system of subsidiarity. And sometimes, when we're talking about charitable things and charitable events and charitable issues, the concept of solidarity, hello, that's another one that's just gone, what is the solidarity that you speak of? But yesterday on the show, we were talking about this, and I said...
Well, it seems to me that the two things, we talk about them as two separate things, but it seems to me they really work fundamentally together.
Okay.
That you're more likely to feel solidarity. That is to say, a sense of membership, a kind of the experience of sharing your fate and destiny with that of others. I mean, something that we know, obviously, from our families, right? We care about our children, we care about our parents, with a kind of intensity that's hard to compare to any other relationship. And you're willing to do things for them.
Sure.
You can sacrifice some of your own interests for their sake. And the more familiar you are with people, the more local and the more communal in many ways the relationships are, the more likely you are to feel a strong sense of solidarity. So that subsidiarity calls for where political, social solutions can be achieved at the most local level, it should be preferred to be achieved at that level. And that's also because you're most likely to be personally engaged in that effort because of your solidarity with those people that you share a life with. And the more diffuse those relationships become, the more distant, the more abstract those relationships become, the less likely you're to feel solidarity.
Sure.
So subsidiarity is really, we could say, it's bound very closely to the ideal of solidarity. This is not to say every problem can be solved in your town hall, but the kind of automatic knee-jerk reaction that most Americans have, that if something is political, it has to be in some ways discussed and debated in Washington, D.C., and we're going to need to have the Supreme Court ultimately rule on this.
Yeah.
It's the wrong way to approach and think about political matters. And this is true of both the left and the right.
True. Well, Patrick, as the English say, bollocks to that. Just as most Americans don't know what bollocks means, so bollocks to that. Here's my final thought. Discussing all these things, and give me a pronouncement on it, Colonel. Rod Dreher calls for a return, a Benedict option. Again, kudos to Dreher. I have my particular disagreements with him on many instances, but that's fine. I believe him to be his intentions are well. I think he's doing a signal duty by doing this, and so is Professor Solon and Archbishop Chapuis. Having said that, I take the marching order going forward for a, quote, Benedict or Saint Benedict option, close quote, and view it from the point of view that, you know what, folks, I think that I think Patrick is right. Modern Christian man, even if it's a small percentage, 5% or whatever it is, the number is growing, is coming to the realization that we can't have this fantastical political order that we have convinced ourselves of, that we had created and was supposed to stand the test of time. And I think that one of the evidences of this is, and I'm sure that this is the continuing of a tradition, but nonetheless, the temptation is to end the tradition. And the continuing of the tradition is, my friend David Simpson has the Monastery Simpson. I'm sure Rod Dreher has the monastery or the Dreher Convent. You live in the Deneen Monastery of sorts, or in the Deneen Abbey. I'm in the Church Abbey. We've already begun, I think, and of course our Christianity would have started this anyway, I think we've already begun the process of the option. So that's what I wanted to ask. That's my final take.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason. So, I mean, you know, as you noted, Rod's book has been covered everywhere. He's being interviewed everywhere, right? I think 20 years ago, if he had written this book, nobody would have paid attention. It would have fallen pretty flat. Obviously something has, in a sense, changed, or the zeitgeist has changed, but it didn't come out of nowhere, right? This has been building for some time. And I think now we've reached this kind of, this boiling point in which all of these efforts that have been taking place, the rise of homeschooling,
sure,
the efforts to build intentional communities with other Christians, the increasing sense that no answer will come out of Washington, D.C., sort of pox on all your houses this election was in part an expression of.
Sure.
I think that this the nature of these books that have all come out at around the same time is not only, of course, trying to promote something, it's articulating something that was already there. And Rod has done so in a particularly winsome and attractive manner, first of all by giving it an attractive title, slightly incomplete without the Saint Benedict, but nevertheless giving it a nice catchphrase by which we can describe this phenomenon. So I think we're at a kind of a new kind of inflection point in our national politics, which in part is going to be an effort to think anew about the nature of the American political order, and it might elicit in some really hopeful directions.
Well, and another way to put that is to be thankful. We oftentimes say, well, this is a rotten age. Wow, everything is rotten around you, et cetera. We live in an absolutely fantastic history is going to view this, hopefully, as what they call a watershed moment in the history of the West and certainly in the history of this continent, that I think you're right. I believe that the gig is up and judgment is going to be pronounced, and it may be more swift than we think.
I agree with you. I think this is it's a time, obviously, of some fear and trepidation and worry and concern and anxiety. It's also a time of a lot of possibility,
sure,
of hope. And I think what maybe one thing is that there's a kind of clarity of vision that escaped us in the last half century or more. So I think it's a time. It's an exciting time to begin to think about these things anew, and to, especially as a Catholic, to offer to the world the answer, the oldest answer in the world that now suddenly appears to be new.
That's a great way to end it. The oldest answer in the world that now all of a sudden appears to be new, said as only Colonel Dineen could say it. Well, my friend, it is always, always a profound honor and a pleasure that you dedicate or donate so much of your time to little old me and our little old crusade channel here. Thank you. I'm telling you, I'll start forwarding you if you want. I'll send you the comments that I get from people because they are substantial of Mike, why don't I hear this on my local radio station? Why? Well, because it's not popular. Truth at this moment, especially this kind of truth, just is not commercially popular.
Well, Mike, maybe that's changing too.
I think it is.
The Benedict option sweeps the land.
I hope it's a number one bestseller for 4 years.
Yeah.
So,
thanks, Mike. I need to go. And
Godspeed, brother. Thank
you. Yale kid's a thing or two. So,
all right.
So
thank you.
I'll leave you now, but thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Appreciate it. That's Patrick J. Dineen, everyone. What, folks? Ponder that.